Gotta get up, gotta get out, gotta get home before the morning comes. What if I'm late? Got a big day, gotta get home before the sun comes up. Up and away, got a big day, sorry can't stay. I gotta run, run, yeah. Gotta get home, pick up the phone, gotta let the people know I'm gonna be late.
Hello everyone, welcome back to the show. So today we're here to talk about the Netflix sensation Russian Doll, which seems to be the talk of the town at the moment. And here to do that with me is the artist better known as Mama Kai, the wonderful Lisa Ferreira. Lisa, how are you doing?
I'm good, Dom. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. So when I knew I wanted to talk about the show, I was scanning through my Twitter timeline looking for who seemed to have caught on to the trend thus far, and I saw quite a few people saying I'm one or two episodes in and this seems like it could be promising. So I thought, I filed their names away in the back of my mind, and then I immediately saw you saying that you finished it, you were obsessed with it, you were already going back to rewatch it, and so my mind was made up at that point.
immediately.
So
and I've been searching for someone to discuss this with forever.
So this is like the perfect forum for that. But what was it that firstly drew you to the show in the first place? Was it like a word of mouth thing, or did you just stumble across it on Netflix one day? And then what was it that kept you watching it after the first episode?
I had not heard anything about it before it showed up on my Netflix trailer thing. And then Natasha Lyonne was all I needed to know. Always have been a giant fan of hers. And I watched the trailer and did not understand it at all. And so I thought, this is for me. And I started watching it on a Saturday night, way too late. Again, one of those things you think you're going to watch one episode. And I think I watched three of them finished it by Sunday afternoon and immediately wanted to watch it again. I just, every single episode, I was more and more interested. It never lagged. The pacing, it's so short. It's not super, super long. It was just, really loved it.
Yeah,
what about you?
Yeah, it's very punchy. Even the scenes that seem like they're a little bit out of place or unnecessary, or they lag a little bit, it always just keeps going. It keeps ticking. And so you're never bored for anything more than a moment. Yeah, that trailer that you mentioned, it was baffling and confusing, and it's not sure how that was meant to even draw people to watch the show. It felt like someone just was on an acid trip or something and somehow came out with that trailer.
Yeah.
So I imagine there are a lot of people out there who, I imagine...
Or maybe they smoked some ketamine.
Yeah.
Huh?
Something from some dodgy Israeli dealer somewhere. But
exactly. War dog.
I imagine there are lots of people who would love Russian Doll if they saw it and took a chance on it, but they saw that trailer and got scared away, and they didn't have the hook of already knowing a lover and loving Natasha Lyonne to keep them interested.
Yeah, and I think when I saw it on Netflix, I think it had still been like a week before I was able to start watching it. But when I did start seeing things tweeting about it or mentioning it, there were a lot of references to Groundhog Day, and I don't know if that would turn people off or not. Yeah, of course, there's like the obvious reliving something over and over, but I didn't find it incredibly similar. And I think maybe people were thrown off by that comparison.
Yeah, it does share the same basic premise, and it's a nice homage to that to drop it and release it on Groundhog Day. Outside of that, it's such a broad concept that there are so many things you can do with it, and I think their take is unique enough that it's not just a blatant ripoff, even though the similarities are obviously there. But as for discovering the show, it feels like nowadays, especially with shows that are on Netflix, it either has to be like an accidental word of mouth thing, or you just stumble across it when you're on Netflix and something about the little icon jumps out to you and you decide to give it a chance. It feels like there's no formal process anymore for discovering a show or kind of getting hooked on a show. Maybe a reviewer that you respect gives it a nice review and that drags you in, but it seems like you just end up watching it somehow and then you get engrossed and you go from there.
Yeah, for sure. There are many shows that I started watching just because everyone on my Twitter feed is talking about it and I feel very left out.
I guess you just need to have friends with good taste, I suppose, or at least maybe a taste that matches yours if your taste isn't up to par.
Yeah, exactly. I do hear a lot about certain shows from clients at the salon that I work. I can hear them outside my office talking to their hairstylist, and they never talk about the cool stuff. So Yeah. It's a good thing I know cool people on Twitter.
What do they talk about instead?
Oh, like that Tim Allen sitcom sometimes I hear people talking about. I don't even know if it's still on, but I feel like they still talk just generic sitcom shows that are on cable. And I don't have cable. I never watch anything on cable. For me, it's all Netflix and Amazon Prime.
Yeah, well, having impeccable taste myself, I couldn't tell you what that Tim Allen sitcom is, but I believe you that it's not worth your time.
Nope, definitely not.
So let's talk about the star of the show here, Natasha Lyonne, who many people will know from things like Orange is the New Black and some of the other shows that she's been on. And I imagine that she has a fairly wide range as an actress, and she's certainly talented enough to step into whatever role is put in front of her. But this kind of role, like the Nadia role and so on, seems so perfect for her and for who she is that this is the type of thing she will always be associated with, even if she continues to move on to bigger and better things.
Yeah, I feel like she's always been the character actor, like the friend of the friend, like the wacky friend or the badass friend. And it's like someone took that badass like side character who's there for comedic effect and put it front and center. And that's what I really love about her. She's not, you know, like, and I think what was the last Netflix show that I watched because everyone else was watching and I hated the girl. Oh, You. Did you watch You?
I did. Yeah, I actually, we have a podcast about that that I haven't got around to editing yet, which hopefully will drop around the same time as this one.
Okay. Well, with You, like I was watching and like Beck was just so unlikable. She was so bland. And it was like, why? And then there's Russian Doll, and where your lead actor is just incredibly charismatic and passionate and not even, maybe not even likable either, but she is endearing, you know?
Yeah, I can understand not liking Nadia, but if you do, it's from completely opposite reasons for someone not liking Beck, who is the most basic, straightforward person you can imagine. Whereas Nadia, for all of her many vices and faults, is who she is, right? She is, you know what you're getting yourself into with her, or at least you think you do.
Yeah.
And the character of Nadia, she's so compelling that even if she's not someone who, like, rationally, you don't think that she would be good for you, or you think that she's trouble, you can't help but be drawn in by her charisma and by her energy. Although some people can help that, apparently, because I've seen some people who watched the first episode and hated Nadia so much that they just dropped it immediately and won't give it a second chance.
What? Really?
Wow. Yeah, and you can see how she could be polarizing, and for a character like Nadia to work, she has to be polarizing in real life. But as a viewer, she's TV gold, right? That's what you sign up for.
Yeah, I think she's almost like that, you know, like in real life, unless you're like her two good friends, Maxine and Lizzie, it seems like she doesn't give a fuck about anybody else. So I think unless you're one of those two people to someone like that in real life, you would not want to hang around with her. Like, she would be fun to go to a party to at like a killer apartment with roast chicken, but it wouldn't really, you know, like having her in your life probably wouldn't benefit you. She would be one of those people that you end up making all of the effort for and she does nothing in return for you. But in the show, I don't know where I was going with that. I had a thought. Lost in the ether.
Yeah, I see the gist of what you're getting at, I think, where she would be fun to be around or just have in your orbit in some capacity, but you feel like you don't really know her unless you're one of her, like, really tight in a circle, unless you're one of her people. And you have to, I'd say you have to be Maxine or Lizzie, who themselves seem very different from each other and from her, to get to that. So I don't know how she picks those people out. Maybe it's just a kind of indescribable thing about them.
Maybe that'll be season two, the prequel.
I thought season two was just going to be told through the eyes of Oatmeal. Like, it's he gradually wears out his nine lives until eventually he has to figure out what's going on.
Or Oatmeal and Horse.
Yeah, they could have this weird buddy comedy together.
Yeah, I love it. I do wish there was more Maxine. I loved Maxine.
Yeah, Maxine is fantastic. And that scene where she's dancing around alone in her empty apartment to the music towards the end is, it's oddly arresting. It's you can see why, like, she's not being vain when she says that. She is the party, and I guess Nadia is too, and maybe that's what draws them in. They're both very fun in their own different, unique ways.
Yeah. And the scene again near the end, I think it's the last episode when she's finally just like, I'm leaving. And Maxine is like, what the fuck? And she throws the water on her and then is just like, no, you can change. And then if you want to go, you can go. Like, they just seem to understand each other.
Yeah. And her throwing the water over Nadia is, it's not even an insult coming from Maxine. It's almost like that's the highest compliment that she could pay to her. And they know each other well enough for that to not be taken as a sign of aggression or anything. It's almost like the perfect loving
gesture. Just dissolve into laughter. Yeah,
but outside of those two, when Nadia's walking through the crowded apartment and she sees all these people, they're her friends, but they're not her actual friends. They're just people who show up because they want a good time, and so does she, but it's very like transactional, and when the night's over, she probably won't see most of them again, and she's perfectly okay with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when people start disappearing, the only two people she cares about are Maxine and Lizzie.
Did you take that as what that was meant to symbolize then?
Symbolize?
Well, just a sign of like what really matters and what she should be focusing on.
Yeah, I mean, I think through the whole thing she's been saying, like she just kind of wants to be alone. She's a loner. She doesn't have any connections. Like, she seems desperate to have that wall and to not make a connection with anyone. She doesn't want to meet Lucy, the daughter. And then when she realizes people disappear, like, that's kind of the first point, I think, when she actually cares about, like, if there's a way to fix it, how do I fix it? Because she didn't realize up until that point that other people might be affected by this. She's just thinking, I can't remember what she's thinking at that right time, because that's after she met Alan. But, you know, like, she seemed so self-centered about it. Like, really, when it all starts happening, she's just like, what's happening? Oh, well. And she just kind of, like, she's super chill about the whole thing. And until people start disappearing, when she notices that that's happening, that's when she starts thinking, like, there's another timeline out there where Ruth is grieving me and where these people have lost me, like 15 other timelines. And that's, I think, really, yeah, like, she's very standoffish, but obviously she loves those people. And obviously it's because of her past, and she's super damaged. And, you know, she's one of those, you can see, like, she's trying to put up a front the whole time, but she's really, she does care more than she wants to, I think.
Yeah, it is very performative, and she is a loner. She does keep to herself, but that's not because she's shy or because she can't draw people to her.
No.
You see multiple people over the course of the series say, you're kind of an asshole, and yet there's something about you that just keeps us around and wanting your attention, even though we know that that's not a healthy attitude to have.
Yeah.
But she just pushes them away, or she finds a way to project this really energetic, bubbly front that is what keeps those people happy, even if it's maybe not a reflection of what she actually sees when she looks in that mirror over and over and over again.
Yeah.
But I did read an interview with the directors where they said that the gradual disappearance of all of these different elements of the show. So first you have some of the animals disappearing, and then like the plant life, and then various people. That was carefully planned out and structured so that things would disappear at different times. And it's the kind of thing which, when you have to put the work in to plot all of that out, you notice and you pay attention to, and you appreciate the symbolism. Mm-hmm. I don't know if most of the viewers will pick up on, okay, this person disappeared here, and then there's this, and so on. It's just you get the gist of it, essentially, and that's you have to be able to rely on that. But it's almost like, I imagine before she notices people disappearing, a lot of them are dropping out of the scene entirely, and before we notice that too, it's just that when the people who she actually cares about, however few they may be, start to disappear, that's when she has to sit up and evaluate what's going on. Because if it's some random person from the party who she doesn't know his name and she'll never see him again, well, whatever. But when everyone starts disappearing en masse, that's when it really becomes a problem.
Yeah.
So what did you make of the party as the backdrop for not just that opening scene, but that scene repeated over and over and over again? Because it feels like the stakes are higher for that scene when you have to craft it, because in a show which focuses on just the linear progression of time, if you mess up a scene or a scene doesn't land in the right way, well, that's unfortunate, but you pick up and you keep going, and hopefully the audience can put them behind them. But if there's a scene which you know will be repeated multiple times every single episode, if you don't get that right, then that's a fundamental problem with the show ultimately.
Yeah. Well, I like that it wasn't absolutely exact, like the way that if you know, you're doing a comparison to Groundhog Day, the way you know, the guy came running at him at the exact same moment in the morning. And this person said the exact same thing. It was like the party was the backdrop, but like the free will of the people in the party was still going, if that makes sense, what I'm trying to say. Like, you know, she would come out and people would, the same people would be there, but they would be in different spots, or Lizzie would be talking to a different woman or a different guy or whatever, or Maxine would be doing something different. Or I read an interview with Greta Lee, who played Maxine, saying that she almost turned it down because the thought of saying the same thing over and over, like of redoing the same scene, just didn't seem like much fun, like having to say sweet birthday baby, you know, like 20 times. But she said, you know, like when she was looking at it, and it was actually very different, and it was a challenge then to make it different. So I think it was a little more loose than, at least, you know, like do it again, but this, just Natasha is going to be different in the scene, you know, or Nadia. But it was definitely a super fun backdrop. I love that in the first episode, Maxine brought out that, what was it? Like the slideshow thing? Yeah, whatever that was, that she bought at a garage sale or something, and she put it to images and music, and there were lights and everything. And that just was such an interesting mood for that to be going on when she's realizing, like, yep, I did die. Like, definitely that's what happened, you know? And she's kind of slowly coming to that realization.
It's a nice physical setting for all of the action too, because it feels very claustrophobic, just seeing Nadia open the bathroom door and then go through that narrow corridor, having to push past people. And then, like, the lights are very dark and it's so crowded. It feels very just cramped and intense. And mm-hmm. you as a viewer, you kind of want to get out of there, and maybe not through the fire escape the way Nadia does, but you want to right. escape, and you want her to free herself from that situation somehow.
Yeah, agreed.
I guess zooming out a little bit and taking more of a big picture view, we've seen this basic premise before, where there's some overarching mystery that the characters are trapped in, and they have to figure out a way to understand what's going on and get themselves out of that situation. And it's always tough as a director, I guess, to know how to pace that and how to set all of this up, because you need there to be some element of mystery. You need there to be some wild goose chases that the characters go on, for the mystery to have some twists and turns, so that you can't just figure out what's going on immediately. And you need those episodes to kind of carry themselves and be self-sustaining, because if they aren't, then it feels like it's just wasted time, and the audience is going to lose interest. So you could see storylines like the Yeshiva thing from early on in the season, or when she has all of these theories in her head as to what might be going on and none of them turn out to be true. They're still fun to watch because Natasha Lyonne is just very fun to watch, but those are the scenes which, when I see all the people saying you have to give it a few episodes, Just stick it through episode 2, episode 3, and then reevaluate and see how you like it. Those might be the culprits there, where you need those scenes to exist for the show to exist, but they're not the strongest part of it. It's something that you have to sit through to get to the good stuff.
Right, yeah, like the whole, when you think of like the whole thing as a whole, like when she goes to War Dog and his supplier and they find out it's ketamine, like that really has nothing to do with the whole show. It's just part of the discovery. And when she goes to talk to the rabbi to find out the history, you know, it has nothing to do with the overall story. But I guess, you know, it's just showing like she's trying to figure out exactly what is happening. Is she tripping? Is she being haunted? Is she a ghost? You know, like, I guess, does that make sense?
Yeah, there's no, yeah, there's no real way to figure out what's going on. And early on, it feels like we are just marking time until we meet Alan, because their two fates will be so heavily intertwined over the course of the season, and the whole premise is figuring out why they're intertwined and how they can separate themselves from each other. So until he appears on the scene, Nadia is just there, and she's there in a very entertaining way, but you know that that's going to be filler ultimately, and nothing's really going to come of that.
Right, yeah. Now, when she does meet Alan, do you think it, like, okay, if you were in this situation, Dom, and you're dying over and over again, and then you meet someone who's like, oh, I die all the time too, wouldn't you, and then, you know, she finds him super fast, so, like, she's goals for online stalking, for sure, but then she just kind of, like, meets him at the party, they talk for a bit, and then they just go their separate ways. Wouldn't you, like, just, investigate that person? Wouldn't you like make that person sit down with you and discuss everything right then? Is that just because she's so distant that she's even just like, well, that's great, you're doing this too, but I'm still going to go do my own thing?
They would have a tough time getting rid of me. I would just be clinging to them until I had some idea of what the hell was going on. And maybe this is just a symptom of her need to be self-sufficient and her difficulties in actually getting close to people or trusting people, which is understandable given her history, but is going to lead her astray here. But yeah, it does feel like there is one of these many alternate timelines in which she meets Alan, she just lets him go his own way, and then that crucial piece of the puzzle to getting out of this cycle, she just never sees him again, and that's the end of that. She's just trapped in purgatory forever.
Right. Crazy.
So maybe she kind of got bailed out from her own bad decisions there, which I'm sure is something that's happened to her many times for her to make it to the age of 36 in the show.
Right, yeah.
What did you make of the character of Alan? Because he's a real study in contrast with Nadia, who is this indescribable ball of energy. You meet her for the first time, it's hard to forget her. Whereas Alan is very just restrained and bland, and sometimes he gets angry over, you know, the smallest thing, but by and large, there's nothing too remarkable about him. If you met him at the party, or you passed him or one of his clones on the street at the parade, you wouldn't think twice about it. So for them to be the two stars of the show, I guess the contrast by itself is interesting, but maybe it's too much if you have two Nadias, or it's too boring if you have two Alans, but having one of each maybe is the right mix that you need for the show to work.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I would definitely watch a show with two Nadias. I think that would be super fun, but maybe like one or two episodes of it.
The people who got sick of one Nadia definitely wouldn't be able to manage two.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he's very nondescript. Like his neighbor, who's amazingly cruel. Wow. Like I can't even imagine saying something like that to someone's face. Just like, I never would have, like if you weren't paying me to watch your fish, like, or to feed your fish, I never would have noticed you or talked to you at all. Like, oh, okay. And then she's super rude to Nadia too later on. Like that girl, what's her story? Why didn't we get an episode on that girl?
And then there's also the neighbor who Nadia meets when she goes to his apartment building, like the old man who's looking at her from the stairs. It's like everyone surrounding Alan seems to just be a really cruel, mean human being. But that's one thing that I think the show does quite well, is having these minor roles and really fleshing them out and giving life to them. Because if you're just an actor looking for work and you see this part for an old man who happens to live in the same apartment complex, you think, well, there's really not much I can do with that. But I don't know the actor's name, but whoever it is who got to play the part of that old man seems to be really enjoying the role, and you can understand why.
Yeah, absolutely. But it was like that with the other roles too, like the woman who worked for the rabbi. Was her name like Shifra?
Yeah.
She was like super just like, I'm not letting a single woman in there. She was great. And same thing with the jewelry store woman. The jewelry store woman was just like really out to steal that scene. She was just like really taking those lines, and I can just imagine her going over those lines in front of her own mirror, like, how can I make this the most antagonistic jewelry store owner or worker I can make it? Yeah, like all the bit roles were very well done. Yeah,
be the best minor jewelry store employee you can be, and she certainly did. But even some of the named roles who maybe are on the next tier up, like Farhan at the deli, just these. The roles who, if they get it wrong, it's not too damaging to the show, but getting it right is just a cherry on top, and they invariably did, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when we start following Alan and Nadia on their journey together, we end up going through some of the same territory over and over again. They're going to die in these hilarious ways, and we're going to discover that they end up dying at the same time, and that their causes of the death are linked sometimes, or that there's some strand here linking the two of them. And the show never makes it clear what that mechanism is or where the responsibility lies. Like, does Alan have to break this? Does Nadia have to break this? Is it a collective effort that they have to do together? And throughout the end of the show, we never get a sense of what that mystery is. Like, there's no person behind it. There's there have been other time travel shows, if you want to lump them in together, where there's some like shadowy organization or mysterious villain who has some like designs on the world, and you have to defeat them to break out of it. With this, it feels like it's just a cosmic event almost, and we are none the wiser about how this works by the end of the series. Maybe it's something which we get some details on in season two, which this will inevitably come back for. But it does mean that when Nadia saves Alan, or Alan saves himself, or they save each other, or however you want to frame that, it feels a little bit out of the blue. It's just, well, okay, that's nice. I'm glad they're safe, but I don't really know how it happened.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, it seems to, like, the vagueness of it, like, okay, Alan decided he needed to go and take responsibility for his part in his relationship failing, and then told Nadia to just go do whatever she had to do to make things right. And she goes to Ruth and talks about her mother, and I guess, you know, realizes or comes to accept that she is not the reason why her mom is dead. And then they're just all of a sudden with another version of themselves. So somehow during that day, because it wasn't at the start of a reset or anything like that, I don't think, right? They saw each other that day and then they left to do their own separate things. Then later that night, they saw each other at the store, but it was a different version of themselves.
So yes, nothing, I think so.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, nothing's really clear there. And then they just walk through the tunnel and suddenly after the parade, they're the right versions with each other.
Right, yeah. And you see the two, like, alternate versions of Nadia walking past her in the parade. So maybe they're still in, like, this split timeline or something. I don't know.
I don't know. And is Horst the one behind everything? Because he's, like, does he know more than, like, what? Is he a godlike figure? I don't understand. Like, in the very first episode, she says, like, I think I know that guy.
Well, yeah.
So why is... I saw someone else tweet in response to Amy, Spool of Lies, on Twitter. Someone had tweeted to her, like, saying, I don't think what we're seeing in the first episode is Nadia's first death.
Right.
Which I thought was an interesting, like, maybe she had died before and she's still, like, and there's something about Horst that is slowly bringing it back to her, you know, and it's kind of slowly coming back. I don't know. But I like shows like that. I like shows that don't tie it all up and explain absolutely everything, because how boring would that be? What is, like, Sigourney Weaver is going to come out of a car and just explain everything to someone? In my head, Sigourney Weaver is behind everything in every movie.
She and Horst working in tandem to mess up the timeline or something.
I mean, I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah, I took that. I agreed with that theory, but maybe in a more mundane way, where to me, the explanation was, she's already in the middle of one of these cycles where she's died and she's come back and she's died and so on and so forth. And when we join her in minute one of episode one, that's what we're seeing. And so when she sees Horst, it's not that Horst himself has any added significance to the wider story. It's just that she remembers him from one of her previous 25 deaths. And so now when we see her on cycle 26, of course she's going to remember something because she's already seen it before, even if she can't quite place it from before.
Yeah, exactly.
But I do prefer this theory where Horst himself is like this mysterious god who is able to, you know, mess with the space-time continuum in some way.
Yeah, and give very bad haircuts.
They're not... Look, I mean, he doesn't have equipment, okay? He might be this all-powerful Time Lord, but he doesn't have the same kind of training that you get in your salon.
That's true, yeah.
I think maybe your standards are just too high for him.
Probably, yeah.
But speaking of having low standards, let's touch on the character of Mike quickly, who
that was perfect.
It seems like he exists more as he says it himself, like, no one's attracted to him, but he I'll find the exact quote because it's so
he's like, he's not a choice, he's the hole where the choice exists, or where the choice could exist, or something.
He says, nobody chooses me. I'm the hole where a choice should be.
Yeah.
Which,
that's so dark.
Yeah, coming from anybody other than him, it would be a really sympathetic quote, really touching. But from him, it's like, well, that's really profound from someone who's such a massive asshole.
Yeah, like, no, you're just okay with that? No interest in changing yourself, becoming a better human being? No? Okay, cool. He's totally fine with that.
Is that why people seem so inexplicably drawn to him? It's like, well, yeah, he's incredibly skeevy, but he's weirdly self-aware about it, and he owns it in a way that someone like Alan, who, yeah, he's a nice guy most of the time or whatever, but he doesn't have that level of self-awareness, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, if you look, like, just pure attractiveness, like classic, what you would consider a classic, like attractive man side by side, Alan is by far more attractive than Mike. But yeah, Mike has the confidence and Alan just could be sitting next to you at a bar for an hour and would never say anything. Whereas Mike would be very forward and confident. And you're like, okay, this guy, like, I understand that. But he's just so, but he's upfront about it. I was going to say like, he's gross, but he's not really gross if he's like upfront about it. He's not like, you know, he's like, I'm just trying to have consensual sex with this young lady. You know, like he's just out there doing his thing, I guess.
Yeah. He's also the type who you can try and have fun with. And then if you don't, or if you just, it's a one and done thing and you never see him again, you don't have any guilt about that whatsoever. No. There's no like pining for Mike after the fact. It's like, you know what you're getting yourself into, what you're signing up for. And if that's your thing, then as long as it's consensual, then so be it.
Absolutely. And like Nadia said, it was mediocre. So I don't think he gets many second dates, to be honest. Just like, all right, it's a way to spend a Friday night, I guess.
Yeah, and he seems perfectly happy with his place in the world. So I do not like Mike, but he's doing his thing and it's working for him.
But the one weird scene with Mike I found so strange, that last episode when he goes to Beatrice's apartment with his baby, with the boy, and he meets Alan, and all of a sudden he's like a totally different person.
Is he though?
He seemed like he was just like kind to Alan, and he wasn't... He just seemed very, and I can't remember if in that reset moment, if they had met at the party before or not. I can't remember if he would have met him before or if that would have been the first time. So he's putting on an act. But he just, because I've watched that twice now, because I've rewatched the whole show again. And I just, yeah, it struck me as odd the first time, and it struck me as odd the second time too, that he just seems like, so like, I wonder if maybe that's a timeline where he actually is a kinder man who's sleeping with someone else's girlfriend. Maybe. I don't know.
I had the impression that they hadn't met before, and Mike in particular is not the type to disguise how he feels about you. So if he is putting on a front, then I guess he truly is a changed man by at that point. Mm-hmm. But even in that in that scene, Mike wasn't really that kind to Alan. He just like tolerated his presence there. And maybe this is Mike's secret, is that because he is so bad most of the time, when he is just clearing an incredibly low bar, like, you're applauding him for it, right?
That's
like
true.
It seems like a much bigger achievement.
That's true. I mean, to me, like, it's the line like, oh, you're leaving. And it didn't come across as sarcastic to me. Like, oh, no, you're leaving. So sad to see you go. I wish you could spend more time with me and your girlfriend, who I am now with. It seemed genuine. Like, are you okay? You're leaving. Like, you don't have to leave. Like, I'm okay if you're okay. It seemed like a different Mike, not the same Mike who, you know, when he's with the other version of Alan, was like, you know, if you hang around here, I'm not responsible for what I'm going to do, like trying to act all big and brave, you know?
Yeah. And that's, again, it's a depressingly low bar. If he can hold a conversation without being cutting, that's, yeah. He's a changed man.
Yeah.
But
he threatened to hit him. Wow.
Yeah. He's been domesticated, which maybe is all you can ask for.
Yeah.
He's one of these secondary characters who you could write the story of Russian Doll without Mike, but having Mike there is just like a fun new angle to it. And
well, it's nice that he's, I don't know, he's another connection between all of that, you know, between Alan, Beatrice, Nadia. He tries to hook up with Maxine that one reset. I don't know if it's just a whole thing about, you know, how connected everybody is and how choices affect other people and all of that. All of that.
I assume. Yeah, all of that. I assume on a show like this, everything has some larger symbolic meaning, and it's all together. It's all part of the same universe. A lot of that is going over my head, but if anyone has any theories, then by all means, educate me about it. But yeah, as Mike says himself, it's not about him specifically, it's what he is and what he represents to other people. And so for some people, that's a one-night stand. But for Nadia and Alan in this universe, he is a crucial clue that they have to figure out before, I guess I was going to say before time runs out, but time never really runs out, right? It just loops back around on itself and keeps going. So it literally can never run out. They're going to have as much time as they want.
Yeah. But although I wonder if, because like they're never really clear on like whenever they die, like sometimes they seem to go into the next day. Sometimes it's all in the one, like they die that night. Like I don't, the one death that was weird to me in that it just, I wasn't sure where, or how it happens, or if there's a reason, if there's like a time, like she has to die by a certain time, is when the second death that we see, when she's got oatmeal right before she falls into the river, and then oatmeal just disappears, like is not there.
Mm.
Like, is it as simple as like, oh, the cat just jumped out of her arms and she didn't notice it and then she just fell? Or is it like, you know, she's had enough time, she needs to die, and then the cat, like, because where did the cat go? How did the cat disappear? What is oatmeal? What is oatmeal?
Oatmeal might just be a drug-induced hallucination. I know that's, I guess that's one explanation.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Which would make it much harder to write season two around him, but they can find a way. I have faith in the directors here.
Yeah.
Those early deaths just seem to happen. They really pile up seemingly at random. And they seem to have a lot of fun finding these increasingly contrived ways for her to die. So when there's like this honeybee infestation within the subway system, or just she's walking across the sidewalk or the pavement, if you prefer, and this garbage can just falls on her head and kills her. Like, you can really, you don't have to be at all realistic about it. You can just do whatever you want and really have some fun. And they definitely make the most of that.
Absolutely. Now with the bees, do you think, is there a part of them like that they manifest that? Because they just talk about, you know, oh my God, you're allergic to bees? Great, I guess bees are going to come. And then the bees come. And she talks about dying in front of Lucy, and then she does die in front of Lucy. Or like she's so worried about going down the stairs, a seemingly innocuous activity that should be super safe, and she dies like 3 or 4 times on the stairs. Is that just like it when they're thinking about it, it'll make it happen? What do you think, Dom? What do you think? I've spent a lot of time thinking about these things and I have no answers.
Well, I don't want to think about it and then manifest that into the universe. So I have to remain carefully neutral. But that is one of the unanswered questions of the show. It's, we know that they have to die and that's determined at some point. But let's say Nadia, realizing that she doesn't want to die in some gruesome, gory fashion, decides, I'm going to stay inside for the rest of my days. I'm not going to expose myself to any plausible danger whatsoever. Does he just eventually die of old age, or does the universe get bored of waiting for her and decide to move things along a bit?
Right. Like she would get a gas leak, or the heat would go out and she'd freeze to death in her own apartment or something like ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah.
A bomb would go off.
The idea that they manifest it gives them a certain kind of agency where I guess they get to choose how they die. But if they're going to die somehow and all you get to do is choose one of the options available to you, then what kind of agency is that really? Like they're just, you know, they get to pick their own poison.
Yeah.
We get a very brief glimpse as well into Nadia's regular life, if you want to call it that. So she has this job as a game developer, and we see her working at home by herself, or at one point she has to go into the office for a code review, where we see the same actors as the guys who were there in the store, like the Wall Street assholes. Yeah. So
and the ambulance
I didn't pick up on that. Yeah, I didn't pick up on that at first, but that's another connection which, when you notice it, or in my case, when it's pointed out to you, the cogs start turning and you wonder what it all means.
Right.
But we get this very brief glimpse into what I imagine her normal existence is when she's not trapped in some crazy time loop where the universe is collapsing on itself. Did you like that? Did that add to her character for you? Because for me, I guess I appreciate having this more flesh out idea of who Nadia is, but there wasn't enough detail there for that to actually amount to anything. So it became more of a distraction than anything else.
Yeah. I mean, it was a nice detail that the game that she designed was a, like when Alan's playing it and he's like, it's impossible. It's you know, the mirroring there of it's a labyrinth and the main character looks exactly like her, has her hair, and she has to do it without any help from anybody else. You know, it's very Nadia. And I guess it's also like a little why she, when she goes into the whole dimension speech to Alan, and she explains, she's like, well, I can think like a computer, you know, but those are the only times that I can recall right now where her background as a software engineer came into play. But I mean, I like knowing that, that she's, she goes to work with these douchebags who don't respect her, and she shows them up in the middle of the meeting. I love that.
Yeah, that was fun. And there's a symbolism to it that is not subtle at all. Like, it's very on the nose. And one of the directors, I think it's Leslie Headland, said in an interview that the reason why they made her a programmer was that, like, the program with which she's living her life has been corrupted, and now she has to kind of find the bug in the code.
Right.
Like, she has to solve the issue that's come up and fix that herself. And that, you know, you can see the obvious tie-in. And being a game developer in particular is like, you often have this thing in video games of you die and then you just respawn, or you get to save your progress and then you start again from a save point. And it definitely feels like that's what's going on here, where eventually she's going to figure out how to defeat the boss or whatever and actually move forward and reach a final destination.
Right. Yeah. So there's something about fish too. I don't really know what it is, but you know, Maxine has fish. Alan has a fish, and he makes a comment, or is it Maxine? Someone makes a comment about, because they have a betta fish, and if there are two of them, they will kill each other. But yet Alan and Nadia are like different. And then Nadia also talks about the memories of fish. Did you notice any fish things, Dom? Like, what, tell me about the fish, because there's something there and I'm grasping.
Clearly I have the memory of a goldfish, because all of this completely passed me by.
Yeah.
But I will sit here and entertain any theories you have as to its larger importance.
Well, I don't know, but Nadia, she goes on this whole rant to Maxine and Lizzie about how, or no, maybe it was to Mike. It was Nadia saying it. I can't remember who she was saying it to, but she's saying, you know, like, fish do have memories. Like, that's bullshit about fish not having memories. And there's and she talks about one species of fish that will remember a human voice telling it to come eat or to feed it or something, like 2 years later. And I don't know how a software developer like Nadia would amass that kind of information, but she seemed to know a lot about the fish. And then the whole, like, they do make a thing about, you know, Maxine's like, which way, her really hilarious, like, which way are the fish? Are they upside down? Are they like, how are the fish? But they show the fish tanks quite a lot. Alan, when the fish is gone, is a big deal. I don't know. But there's something about the betta fish. When there's two of them, they will kill each other. Like, so there can only be one, which is a very video game kind of thing too. I don't know.
Maybe it's like, if you have two versions of yourself and one is better in some way or stronger or whatever, then that one will devour the other one. And so you have to, there's like this process of self-improvement where you have to be the best fish you can be so that you don't get swallowed by, you know, these other versions of yourself. I don't know. I'm just spitballing here. Feel free to jump in and save me for myself.
No, I don't know. I'm just like, fish. There's something with the fish.
There's always something with fish in my experience.
Yeah. But,
there's also this recurring motif throughout the second half of the season with the moldy fruit.
Yes.
Where as soon as you see it the first time, you start seeing it all the time, which there's like a, there's some name for that effect, which I don't know what it is, and I can't Wikipedia it live, but that thing where you see something for the first time, and then you see examples of it everywhere you look, and then you wonder if you've been missing out on it the whole time, or if it is really just a new thing.
Yeah.
So when you see that, they really lay all that on thick. They have these extended shots of like rotting oranges in the deli or whatever, and I was wondering if that was like meant to be a useful marker to the audience of, when you see this, this is a sign that we're in a certain type of timeline or something, because you see this a lot on shows that care about time travel, where they acknowledge that they're the ones writing the plot, so it makes sense to them and it's easy for them to keep track of because it's their job and they have to do it. If you're watching the show, you don't have to put that much effort into keeping track of five different timelines at the same time. So if you have this non-intrusive but still obvious indication of where in one of those timelines you are, then that's something you can always go back to. So I wondered if it was meant to be that, or if there was some clearly too subtle for me symbolism there of what was going on or what the real deal was there.
Yeah, I mean, on my rewatch, I didn't notice very many shots of fruit that wasn't moldy before it went moldy, but there were a few shots of the flowers before you start to see the flowers fade. You see, there are a few shots of the flowers looking beautiful and fresh that I honestly did not notice on my first watch because it's just flowers and you only notice it when there's, you know, something's wrong with it. But it was interesting when she cut into the orange, when she's explaining to Alan about like, here's the fourth dimension, you know, and it was fresh on the inside, was just like, she was talking about it in a way of just like the universe is breaking down around us kind of thing. Like everything's kind of crumbling and falling apart. Like the coding is wrong, you know? But it's weird. Like, it's only certain things like that. So it must be just put in there as like placement, like time placement, because otherwise why aren't all the trees in that park like dying and, you know?
Yeah, I guess it's tempting to look at the first reality you see as like the real one. And then in each successive cycle, when something wacky happens or something changes, you look at that as like a deviation from what you're expecting or what's meant to be. Whereas if we go back to this idea of we're launched into the middle of one of those cycles in the first place, then we don't know what the default is, right? Like we don't know what is real and what isn't, or I don't know where I'm going with this answer. I don't know anything. We're all just trying to figure things out.
No, I mean, there are many times watching the show where I feel like, okay, so, and after the orange thing, I feel like, okay, they're telling us, like, as the viewers, that it is a timeline thing, right? Because that's what she's explaining to him. Like, there is a timeline somewhere where all of this fruit is fresh everywhere, you know? And there's a timeline where Ruth is grieving me because she thinks she shot me with a gun. And there is this timeline and there is that timeline. And so I start thinking, like, okay, these are all real timelines. But then the one part that really just made me think, I was totally wrong with that, was when she does finally sit down with Lucy. And at that point, like, she's seen the younger version of herself a few times. So she's kind of fucked up from that. And that's just weird. But then that scene with Lucy, when she dies in front of Lucy and Lucy doesn't, like, is Lucy real there? Is that whole thing real at all, or like in a timeline, or is it all a hallucination? Is it all a dream? Like, is none of it real? Is she actually in purgatory? Like, what is happening in that scene? I don't understand. The little girl's talking to, like, younger her is talking to her. She's pulling off like the mirror from her mouth. The little girl has blood all over her face because she just spit the blood at her, and she's just super chill about it. And it's weird and dark and all Emily of New Moon, but like, what? Dumb. What? What do you think about that scene?
What I think about that scene is that small children in time travel shows are always super weird and super creepy. Like, yeah, there's always some scene where you see a previous version of yourself, and it's never just a happy child merrily frolicking around with no cares in the world. It's always some, like, The Shining style thing where they're just staring directly at you or whatever, and it's always very unnerving.
Yeah. But, like, do you think Lucy's real in that scene?
I don't know. Lucy is a metaphor. Everything is a metaphor. Nothing exists. You don't exist. I'm just talking to myself here. I don't know. This is maybe this itself is a test from the universe.
So confusing. Are you familiar with Emily of New Moon at all?
I'm not.
It's I mean, I haven't read it since I was a child, but I was a giant Anne of Green Gables fan, and I definitely have a copy of Emily of New Moon somewhere. But it's true, like what she says to Ruth, like she was a darker Anne of Green Gables. She's an orphan like Anne, but Anne was so, you know, just like precocious, and she just put on a front or whatever. And Emily was super just dark and depressed, and like she would just have the most biting comebacks to people. It made me want to read it again for sure, because they reference it so much in this book. But I do get Nadia, whose mother died at, you know, when she was a young, like that was kind of the age she would have been at when Emily was an orphan in the book. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it made me want to read it again.
What did you make of that subplot, if you like, where we get to see some of Nadia's backstory. We see the damage that her mother did to her and how similar the two of them are in a lot of ways. And then that's intertwined with Nadia getting these visions of herself, of the younger version of herself, and that almost like infects her reality, where she can't just go about her day as if things are normal because she's having these hallucinations all the time. So that escalates the mystery and the stakes of the show. Did it do that in a way that was satisfying or compelling for you?
I loved all the flashbacks with Chloe Sevigny as the mom.
Was it just to see Chloe Sevigny, or did you think that the role that she plays there is important?
No, the role for sure. I think, you know, to see Nadia as a child and what she would have had to, like that scene where she's just buying all of the watermelon and is cutting up the watermelon and Ruth is trying to say, like, you should probably eat some soup, you know, like you can't just eat the water, you know, and like you can see Ruth trying to hover or protect her without being taking over for her mother, but realizing that's necessary. I don't really know if they ever really went into how Ruth and the mom became so entwined. Like, was she just her doctor? And I know they said like Nadia then ended up living with her. So she ended up being, you know, her guardian after her mom died. Did they talk about that at all?
I don't think so, because they clearly don't have the kind of distance that you would hope and expect a therapist to have with their patient, for instance.
Right.
So
yeah.
In the first scene where Ruth appears, I thought she was a family member, like an aunt, or because they had quite similar like communication styles and mannerisms, and I thought maybe she and Nadia's mom are sisters, or there's some dynamic there that explains what's going on, because it's definitely not a conventional doctor-patient thing.
No, and it's just I liked seeing that though, and like knowing that Ruth was there in Nadia's life as a child. Like she's the one person in this current world that we're watching that was there with her and saw her go through that and like truly knows the kind of shit that she had to deal with and like the kind of damage that she would have from that. It's kind of weird that it took her dying like 20 times to actually sit down and talk to this woman who's super close. And it seems like she looks up to her and she protects her to have this conversation where she says like, no, that's not what happened. But I guess that speaks to Nadia just kind of shutting people out.
And shutting them out so completely that it takes, as you said, her dying over and over and over again to open up to the one person in her life who seems to be her most trusted confidant.
Right. And to say to her like, well, when this happened, and then Ruth says, that's not how it happened. Like, this is how it happened. And it's like, that's the you guys just needed to sit down and talk about that. And then you would have been like, okay, I can maybe let this go, like at some point, you know? But yeah, I think, it speaks to how fucked up she is over all of that. But I really liked that episode. I did like that episode a lot with all the young Nadia.
Yeah, it was fun, but it's one of those, and it often is these penultimate episodes of shows where they take this hard left turn and veer into unexpected territory and then kind of come back onto the road for the finale in lieu of trying to set up some cliffhanger or something else. It's almost like at this crucial point in the story, we're going to show you something completely different as a way of, it's almost like a palate cleanser to put you in the right mindset for the finale. I don't know. It's just a trend that has stood out to me a lot. But in this case, what do you think seeing the effect that Nadia's mother had on her is meant to say about how much agency she has? Because if it is just a case of Nadia could have been this very just like normal, well-adjusted adult, but instead having to live with her mother and seeing all the damage that caused turns her into who she is, then there's no way that she can fix that, right? No matter how many timelines she goes back through, if she wakes up in one of those timelines as 35-year-old Nadia about to turn 36, there's no way to undo those mistakes. She will always have to live with those. So maybe that's a takeaway, is that some things in your life you can't change and anything in the past you can't change. So you just have to deal with it and accept it for what it is, or what do you think they're going for with that?
Well, I think there's something that Ruth says about, I can't remember what it was exactly, but something again with like a different version of someone, you know, like you, or like that she was a child that was full of life. Is there anything of that still in you now? And I think it's, you know, they're going on the theme of just, there are different versions, and maybe you like make a choice and it, you go one direction, but you could have gone the other direction, and maybe somewhere that other direction exists, you know, like she says, like her mom was obviously dealing with a lot, and but that didn't mean that she didn't love her. She just couldn't care for her the way that she should have been able to.
So with that, I think it does help to humanize Nadia a lot, and we've seen the whole story through her perspective, or from her perspectives, I guess you could say, so far. And if you didn't like Nadia as a character to begin with, then I guess you wouldn't make it this far, because you've turned the show off in disgust. But if you do, or you can at least tolerate her, then you get a good sense of who she is, and this helps to expand on that even further. But I wonder if you could extend the same humanizing element to other characters in the show. So someone like Mike, for instance, we know him as just like this irredeemable asshole, but is there something in his past that twisted his personality to make him this irredeemable asshole, or is that just a product of choices that he's making, and he has this switch that he could just turn off and be a normal healthy adult if he wanted to be?
Yeah, like he says, all of this stuff is in, I find people are fascinating, right, in any context, real, imaginary, fiction, real. It's just you never know anybody's history, and it always is a factor in who they are and what they present to the world. I would love to see Mike's backstory. Like, he mentions that him and his son's mom split a year ago. Maybe he was a totally decent guy up to that point and didn't fuck around with any of his students or any of his grads, right? Is Beatrice his grad student? I feel like.
Yeah.
She works with him or something. And maybe he was totally legit, and maybe that woman completely burned him and broke him and tortured him. And maybe that would be interesting to see. Or maybe his father wasn't around, or his father was exactly the kind of guy that he is now. Like, that would all be any time I see something personally about like someone who's supposed to be an asshole or something like that, and I understand their past, it makes it a little more well-rounded for me. If that, yeah.
As a character or in life as well?
In life as well. I mean, if someone like fucks me over, it's not going to matter. I can try and try. I mean, I have a history of being extra forgiving. You know, that only take someone so far before it's like, okay, like your past gets you this many passes, you know, and that's it. I think as well-rounded as possible informs something. Like, if I'm doing a play and I have a character and it says all of this, whatever, in my head, like, I always do an exercise where I go back and I think about the kind of life this person would have led to make them make the choices that they make in the play. And that informs how I play that character and how I deliver those lines and the body language and all of that. And so I thirst for the knowledge of characters, Dom.
Yeah, it is. I think it's a good attitude to have, but when you try to apply it in practice, I find that people often apply it quite inconsistently, because it's, you have to be wired a certain way, I think, to be that forgiving towards everybody. So I find that often people are quite selective in who they give those second chances to, or who they wait for more details to arrive at a conclusion for. And those choices by themselves are quite revealing about that person. So you do often see people who act in a way that really should, maybe can be forgiven, but should at least put your guard up for next time. But they constantly get these second and third and fourth and fifth chances because, oh, they're so fun to be around, or they're so, you know, people find reasons to fill in that blank.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's almost more egalitarian to be like, okay, I have one strike and you're out policy, or I'm going to be open and forgiving towards everyone, which is much harder to do.
Oh yeah, of course. And I mean, it's all comes down to what you get out of that relationship, I think. You know, like if it's someone that I don't really care about and I'm not really feeling any kind of effort from that person, if there's even a slightest anything, even knowing their past is just kind of like, okay, I get it, but like, I'm done with you. Whereas if it's someone that you've invested any amount of yourself into, it's a little more difficult to make that final call, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And yeah, tying this back to the Groundhog Day comparisons, maybe that idea, that basic idea by itself becomes oddly self-referential if we're doomed to see the same show with the same premise over and over and over again, like whether it's that or it's Russian Doll or whatever the next variation on that theme happens to be. But the message there, as I understood it at least, was that if you're going to make progress with the one timeline that you actually have in the real world, then you have to have a healthy perspective on your past mistakes and your past actions and learn from those and just iterate on yourself and improve yourself as a human being. And for me, I'm not sure what Russian Doll really tries to say about that message, because we see Nadia and Alan, what ends up tying them together, it seems like, is if they were able to help each other out, then Alan wouldn't have killed himself, and then Nadia would have ended up with a different fate too. But it's unclear exactly why the two of them were tied together, because that idea is centered on Alan, who meets a far more gruesome fate than Nadia does. So why is it Nadia who has to go through this experience over and over again with him instead of the many other people in Alan's life who could have stepped in, could have saved him, or could have done something previously to alter the outcome?
Yeah, exactly. It seems like a lot to be placed on this stranger, that she should have saved this guy who was super drunk in a convenience store. It is a little weird. And especially, yeah, because of his first death and how much darker that is than just getting hit by a car because you think you see your cat across the street and you just run out without thinking. And, you know, you'd think if that was Alan's fate, his first death, he must also have quite a past to make him the way that he is, where he's so, like, when Beatrice is talking about the way he, like, he cannot change. He cannot deal with change. Everything has to be a certain way. It has to be routine. Why, like, is he not haunted by a younger version of himself or something? Because it just seems like Nadia dies when she sees her younger version and he ends up dying as well at the same time because they're linked. But what is the real demon with Alan? It seems like everything is fine with Alan after he has that last conversation with Beatrice and he kind of, you know, accepts, like says, no, like it's my fault that our relationship died too. And I should have seen it and I didn't. And, you know, blah, blah, blah. That does seem a little simpler than Nadia's task.
Yeah. And with Alan's specific mode of death, it's a difficult thing for them to navigate as writers too, because if they have a message about agency and they're tying that into suicide, then that potentially gets into some quite dangerous territory. So they almost have to stay clear of that by just presenting it as, oh, well, this is just one part of a larger mystery, and we'll wipe our hands clean of that and try not to say anything that could be misconstrued.
Yeah,
because go ahead, finish the thought.
No, go ahead.
Because Nadia, at one point, she sees the signs of impending suicide in Alan, that his mood is suddenly much more buoyant, he's giving away all of his possessions and so on. And it's unclear if that's something which Nadia knows in general, because beneath all of her bluster, she is an empathetic person, or she's just being told that those are the signs, or this is a callback to knowledge that she has about him from a previous timeline, where like she's able to recognize that in a way that in real life she wouldn't, because she doesn't have that existing knowledge.
Right. Yeah, like the initial night when she did see him, she didn't even go over to him, right? Like she just talked to the three guys and then she went back to Mike.
Right. And you would not want her to stage an intervention for every single random drunk person that you see late night at a convenience store, right?
Like, if that's the message, if they're trying to tell us like that is the message, oh my God. the world is about to become super annoying.
Right, like that. She cannot and definitely should not try to do that. So yeah. We're left casting around for a different message instead.
Yeah.
And so with Alan, it's not like, so it's almost suggesting that him killing himself could have been avoided if like this one random thing happened on that night, which is true insofar as it's often a quite impulsive decision in the moment. And so you change one like external factor and maybe the whole thing goes differently. But in terms of the wider context, I don't think they're going for some feel-good message about, oh, well, if only people had just been nicer to Alan, then things would have gone completely differently. Like, I don't think they're going for anything as reductive as that.
No, I hope not. Yeah. I don't know. It's interesting that Alan is the kind of person who, you know, like Nadia relives that birthday party, like, you know, for all intents and purposes, a killer birthday party. Like, that's an awesome party. That's what she relives every single time she restarts. Alan goes through the same day. And what I got from the first few episodes that Alan was featured in is that he still does the exact same thing every single day, right? Like, he waits for the old man so that he can open the door for the old man. And then he goes and he sits through that breakup every single time. It's only when Nadia comes with him there that she actually like stands up for Alan and is kind of rude to Beatrice. So like every single time he has gone there and he's relived that and he's just sat there every single time without saying anything. Like, I would like to think that if I had to relive like the worst breakup of my life or something, I would have some like extra zingers to throw in there or something, you know, like I would make it extremely painful for the other person if they were hurting me or okay, maybe that's not the message Russian Bell's trying to give. or go in there with Alan's final thing of just like, okay, this is never going to change. Why does he show up at all? You know, why doesn't he just abandon her and make her just like, whatever, who cares at that point? If you're just, you keep dying and reliving, why would you go back just because you're supposed to see her on that day if you know that that's what's going to happen? Like, do you think he thinks there might be a different outcome every time that he goes?
Yeah, because I think there's two sides to that. There's if he already is having those thoughts, then maybe the breakup and how messy it was is going to be the one specific trigger that takes that to the next level, whereas it could have been anything else. Like, if it wasn't this, then some other traumatic event in the future could have done that. But then that also gets into that messy territory where it's like, are you implying that it was preordained and it couldn't have gone any differently? Or like, if only he goes into this with a different mindset, then everything would be okay. It's almost like it's dodging the question of having to take a stance on that issue, I think it's fine. I don't think they should have to take a stance on it. But it means that the plot is missing something. There's there's a hole in the carpet somewhere.
Right. Yeah. But yeah, I do think there's something in, you know, he's obviously so rigid and does not like change, and he has to do something different on that last day for him to make things right in the universe or whatever. And she's so intent on being disconnected from people that she has to like attach herself to this person and save his life for her to fix the universe. You know, like, that is a nice kind of symmetry, I guess, even though hers still feels like way more to do than his.
Yeah, but Beatrice has that killer line of, there's so much I want to do and you want to stay exactly the same, which is a very astute and therefore very biting criticism.
Yeah.
But over the course of the show, we see Nadia and Alan do so many different things in an attempt to get themselves out of their situation. And if their lives were fine, if they were completely satisfied with who they were, they wouldn't need to go through all of that. And you would want them to stay exactly the same because they've reached a place in their lives that they're happy with. Right. So I'm not sure what the takeaway from that is meant to be.
Well, I wonder if like the takeaway is supposed to be that like this happens to everybody who dies. If you have unfinished business, like this is the new afterlife or like the new thing. Like you will, like she says to that old man when he's talking about his wife who died of lung cancer. And she's like, well, there's a timeline where she's sipping a Mai Tai on a beach somewhere. And it's like, is that the premise that this is like the after. So like, even though they're together now in their new timeline, was that original death still like legit? Like, are they dead? Like, is that this afterlife kind of timeline? Is that what this is? You tell me.
Tune in for season two to find out. Yeah. Like,
it's so interesting.
It leaves the door open for so many twists on that theme. And that's why, as you said earlier, it might be smart to leave some of these questions unanswered, because if season one wraps up the story of Nadia and Alan, and this is just the story of Nadia and Alan, then yeah, what once Netflix renews you for a second season, you'll really have to rack your brains to think about where you can go from here. Whereas now you still have a blank canvas effectively that you can make something new.
Yeah. I read that the creators pitched it to Netflix as a 3-season series, which makes me happy that it wasn't just like, well, they made this one like closed ended thing. And then it's like, what do we do now? You know, like, so ideally they have a plan of where this goes and what kind of story they're going to tell for seasons 2 and 3, if that's happening. But I'm insanely curious for that.
And as it happens, Alan is finally saved when Nadia shows up and is able to talk him off the ledge, literally and metaphorically. And he asks, do you promise that if I don't jump, I'll be happy? And in one of the best lines of the series, she says, absolutely not, but I'll promise you, you'll not be alone.
And very touching, especially coming from her, who keeps saying she wants to be alone.
Well, there's that too, which I didn't even think about. But also, it's so perfect coming from her, because it has that honesty to it. Like, she's not going to lie to him and blow smoke up his ass and promise that, oh yeah, you'll be fine, don't worry, everything gets better, you know?
Yeah.
But she gives the answer which I think anyone should give in that situation, and that specifically is the only answer she can give, which is that, no, but I'll be there for you, you know? And we'll get through it. And there's, I can't remember where, but there's a line to the effect, it's something to the effect of, the worst thing isn't being alone, it's being around people who make you feel alone. That's kind of what we see in Nadia's party, right, where she has all of these friends there, or friends of friends, but there's still something completely unsatisfying about it, and most of them just have this transient role in her life, whereas by the time she's talking Alan out of suicide, like, they've established this bond where she, like, he knows he'll be there for her, and vice versa, basically. And that's really what both of them need, not just in that situation, but in any situation. And that's what lets them finally escape from this whole paradox.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the alone and the, like, she's in that party and it's for her. And she's completely lonely. You know, she's got her two best friends, but everybody at that party, like, none of them are anything to her except people who are sometimes at parties she goes to, you know, or like people on her peripheral, like just people she kind of knows or whatever. And there is something like she is living a very lonely life before she meets Alan, because like she says to him when she's like, great, I'm attached to you forever, like this is it for all of eternity, like great. And he's so offended and he looks hurt, and she says like, I just don't want to be attached to anybody. Like, it's not you. It's just, I don't want to be attached to anybody. And she is so detached. And then at the end, for her to say to Alan, like, you won't be alone, it's really sweet.
Mm-hmm. So that about covers most of what I have. What other loose ends can we tie up in this timeline? Is there anything else that we haven't got to yet that you think needs to be discussed?
Cottage cheese. Is it coming back?
Not if I have anything to say about it, but
it was such a great reference, because I thought, like, when was the last time I bought cottage? Like, I feel like in my life, my adult life, I have gone through cottage cheese phases where I'll buy cottage cheese like every time I go to the grocery store for like a month, and then I won't do it for like 6 years, and then I'll think about cottage cheese again. And like, I don't think I thought about, like, even thought about cottage cheese for like 5 years.
This is a controversial view, which I will bury 80 minutes into a Russian Doll podcast, so hopefully it won't get too much backlash. But I just don't see it with cheese. I'm not a cheese guy.
With
I've never
cheese?
Understood.
Like
yeah,
all
just
cheese?
Cheese as a concept.
As a concept. Oh my gosh. We clearly should have gotten together in person to do this. And I will next time I will bring a cheese board and I will blow your mind with cheeses. Clear, like, are you just having like Cracker Barrel cheese? Because that's not the cheese to eat. Like a good brie.
Is there a good brie though? I feel like that's the crux of the issue.
Oh my gosh, a camembert. Oh my gosh.
Mm.
Okay.
I guess what if you have any dairy at all, like the concept of cheese shouldn't be that much more strange or advanced, but even so, it just, I never got it. I never understood the hype. Mm.
Well, I mean, cottage cheese is like the lowest of the cheese as far as I'm concerned. Like, I don't even consider that cheese. I consider that more of like a lumpy sour cream kind of. It's just there, but wow. Yeah. I mean, a good cheese is a good cheese. There's a cheese festival in Toronto in September. So just saying, Dom, maybe you should go to that.
I'll consider it. Maybe that's what I have to do to break out of this loop that I put myself in.
Maybe that's it. Just gotta learn to love cheese.
Well, if you have any feedback on cheese or this podcast or anything else, you can find me on Twitter at DomHRV. I assume, Lisa, you can be found on basically any platform at Mama of Kai.
That
yes?
is true. Yes, yes.
Got to have that consistent branding going on.
Yes.
But if you've made it this far, then I can confirm for you that you are beautiful, you are loved and deserve love, and you are in control, at least for now. But thank you very much for listening, and we'll talk to all of you again soon. Take care, everyone.